The Musician's Map ebook is the new definitive guide on building success in music. Whether you're just starting out, or you're looking for gigs, or you're trying to make a career, the Musician's Map ebook is right for you. The Musician's Map ebook contains 20 years of music industry experience distilled into a 40,000 word guide to achieving your goals in music. Can't read? Get the Musician's Map audiobook. 4.5 hours of author Kane Power speaking directly into your own ears. That's right, even you can still benefit from the Musician's Map Guide to Building Success in Music. Head to musiciansmap.org/books right now to get your copy of the Musician's Map ebook or audiobook. Get it today and receive a special one-time-only offer of a personal pat on the back from author and podcast personality Kane Power. The Musician's Map ebook and audiobook is also available at Amazon and Audible if you feel like supporting those giant websites as well. The Musician's Map ebook, your guide to building success in music. Proof of purchase required for pat on the back. To receive a pat on the back, you must travel to Raglan, New Zealand. Travel not included in purchase price.
I'm all for a drink. In fact, if you put me in almost any group of people, I'd probably be one of the first to put my hand up for a drink or two, or three. But up until now, over maybe 20 years of regularly drinking alcohol, I've been able to maintain a fair amount of control over my consumption. I might drink more than many people, but I don't think I've ever had a serious problem with alcohol. I have, however, seen many, many people who have had a problem. Some of them friends, many of them musicians. As musicians, we find ourselves inextricably linked with the alcohol industry. How many music venues can you think of that don't sell booze? This might not seem like the biggest issue facing musicians, but I think it's a problem, and I think we need to take a closer look at how this association between alcohol and music is affecting the lives, careers, and integrity of our artists. Alcohol is a serious drug that doesn't just ruin the odd gig or occasionally stifle the chance of a promising career. It ruins lives. It kills. This week, we're talking about alcohol in music, its role, its influence, and its consequences. I'm going to share my thoughts and we'll hear some expert opinion on the matter. But first, a culture of cool. I might be showing my age here, but as a teenager, who else remembers the iconic vision of a permanently wasted rock star? For me, it was figures like Kurt Cobain, Marilyn Manson, Scott Weiland, Keith Richards, bands like Kiss, Oasis, Frenzel Rom, Pantera, Guns N' Roses, Metallica, and perhaps the poster child of the wasted performer, Janis Joplin. We came to expect images and video clips of beer-soaked performances, swigging straight out of bottles of Jack Daniels on stage, debauched after parties, and songs about drinking and drugs. Who remembers Tommy Lee from Motley Crue downing a bottle of Jack while still playing the drums? I sure do. But why is it that if we saw a guy on the street chugging straight bourbon from the bottle, we'd think it was disgusting and sad? But when Tommy Lee does it in front of millions of people, it's the epitome of cool. To me and to millions of others, these people were the role models for our formative years, the stars we aspired to be. To my impressionable young mind, being wasted and drunk was synonymous with being a rock star. They made it look so fun and appealing that my friends and I would mimic them whenever we could get our underage hands on some booze. These guys were so successful while seemingly constantly drunk or on drugs, we thought it was how you became a rock star. That being an alcoholic was almost a rite of passage to becoming a musician. All the greats were on drugs, right? It's how you write a good song. Musicians have a knack of making addiction seem cool. The arrogant swagger, bottle of branded bourbon in one hand, cigarette in the other, between song quips of "Who wants to get high?" are met with cheers and applause. Look at this model rock star. Confident, cool, and comfortably wasted. So when I started playing in bands, what was I doing? I was trying to imitate my heroes by drinking whenever I was making music. In fact, If I really think about it, if I came round to your house for a jam tonight, I'd probably bring a six-pack. That's how ingrained drinking is with my process and enjoyment of making music. Except, I've been a musician for 20 years, and up until a couple of years ago, I thought making music would be my career. Recently, I've been on a little break from making music, although I'm heading back to it now, but I sure as hell haven't been on a break from booze. I guess the point I'm trying to make is that our young musicians are still growing up in a culture where alcohol and drug abuse is seen as something that's cool and acceptable for successful musicians. It's influencing their decisions, it's influencing their progression, and it's impacting their art. And that's a problem. So where does it start? Gigs. Let's think about the most common situation that leads us to think a drink might be helpful. Who listening has been nervous before a gig? I certainly have, and I know from years of experience that alcohol makes getting on stage in front of a room full of people a whole lot easier. It lowers inhibitions, boosts confidence, and enhances your performance. The problem here is that it also makes you sloppy. If I have more than one beer before playing the drums, I will not be as tight as I would be if I was sober. I might be a better performer, I might play with more swagger, I might even have more fun, but my timing will drift, my dynamics will be off, and the audience's overall impression of my songs will be affected. When you're drunk, you perceive yourself as playing better, but it's not always the case. If you're drunk, people will notice, and that might not be a good thing. Usually, when you see someone on stage that's really wasted, especially at amateur level, it's really embarrassing, and 9 times out of 10, they honestly sound like crap. Drinking booze before your show is actually counteractive to your goals as a musician. Think about it. You spend years and years learning, practicing, and building your skill. Thousands of dollars on equipment, rehearsals, promotion, and recording. Then you get drunk before you get on stage and ruin your own gig. It's sabotage. This was your chance to impress people, get new fans, and spread your music. You've put in all that effort. Don't blow it over a couple of beers. You're not doing yourself or your music justice. Another issue here, however, is that there's also a kind of expectation surrounding musicians and live gigs. Fans expect a great performance and almost expect artists to be drinking on stage and or already comfortably drunk. It's also imprinted in their minds that musicians and alcohol are two sides of the same coin, and quite often the audience you're playing to is drunk themselves. For some people, the only way to get them to a gig is the promise that once they're there, they can buy beer. Because yet another issue is that the venues where these gigs take place are, 95% of the time, surviving on the sale of alcohol. For small music venues, selling booze is how they survive. Here's Tom Anderson, a musician, sound engineer, and co-owner of Auckland venue Whammy Bar, with his thoughts from our podcast together in August 2017.
The alcohol and music industries are, you know, inextricably linked together, to the point where I own a music venue and get to bring all these amazing bands through, and I'm super proud of it. But if I wasn't selling booze, the venue wouldn't exist, and therefore the space, you know, like in this particular context within New Zealand, that's the way that the music industry works, and sponsorship and bands are given free beer before they're given free food, and you know, like, so there's a lot of that that goes on that is just a fact of it. And because of that, you know, bands will often be like, how many beers can I get, or whatever. The touring game particularly is very focused around alcohol and drugs, depending on what scene and group you're in, you know, like the number of bands that come through, that the first question is, you know,
Do we get beers?
Or, you know, where can I get some weed, or, you know, what do you got kind of thing, you know, like from high level to lower level. And that could be for just during the day or after the gig or whatever, but drugs and alcohol are a massive part of music. Mm. I've seen amazing gigs where people have definitely been on something, but in control. But someone else might have taken the same amount of drugs or alcohol as them and put on a really crappy gig. So yeah, don't be an embarrassment. until at least after the show.
Yeah.
And even then, don't be an embarrassment, because the amount of bands that then get wasted and then be a dick to the bar staff, or be a dick to someone else in the venue or the sound engineer or whatever, you know? So basically having some degree of control.
You can find out more about Tom and his projects and Whammy Bar in the podcast notes with this episode. There's a really good open letter from bar owner Chris LeDrew where he talks about this in Onstage magazine from an article in October 2013. Here's a quote from the letter. "Live music is important to most of us if we have that kind of venue, but it is a significant expense and is only worthwhile if it produces more than it consumes. Just like advertising and anything else we spend money on in order to sell more ounces." He's referring to ounces of alcohol here. "But so many of the bands that come through here have no clue what their job is. Your job is to sell booze. You're not here for any other reason." You can find a link to the full letter in the episode notes of this podcast. So our venues are sponsored by alcohol brands, and they are only able to put on gigs because they sell alcohol. And in many cases, only book music acts in order to sell alcohol, because people won't come to gigs unless they can drink, and the venue won't survive without selling alcohol. I mean, if this isn't indoctrination or the sign of a serious problem within our culture, you tell me what it is. And I can almost hear many of you saying, "Kane, what about all ages shows and dry venues? They do exist." And you'd be right, yes, they do exist. But just as an exercise, take a look at your local gig guide for the next month and see where all the gigs are being held. Are they at churches and youth centres and schools? No, they're at bars and licensed venues. But for musicians, the problem gets even worse. Touring and the cost of drinking. Life on the road can be super fun. You're travelling, playing shows, meeting people, partying and hanging out with your mates. So naturally, you want to drink, and drinking is encouraged everywhere you go. On the flip side, touring can also be extremely difficult. You're often stuck in a van for long hours every day. You're eating poorly, you're not sleeping well. A great way to overcome your bad mood or your tiredness or the tediums of playing show after show after show can be to drink. A night out for a concert goer is just that. It's one night out. Whereas for touring musicians, this can be every single night. You wake up on a floor somewhere and load into the van to drive to the next city. Breakfast is from a petrol station or takeaway restaurant. You drive all day and get to the venue in time for soundcheck. You soundcheck, then you might have a few hours to kill before you play. It just so happens that many venues will pay you partially in alcohol in the form of a rider. Drinks for the band to get them in the mood. So what do? You start drinking. The venue wants you to put on a good show, and giving you a few drinks costs them almost nothing. In most places, you'll get free drinks before you're offered any food. Which kind of raises the question of the employer-employee relationship. They're hiring you to do your job and entertain their customers, and essentially they're paying you to get drunk. In what other profession is it acceptable to drink while you're at work? And the gig itself isn't where the business aspect of touring ends. You're also trying to form lasting relationships with not only your fans, but the promoter, the venue owner, other bands, the sound engineer, and the bar staff. You need to come across as cooperative, professional, and likable, not messy, arrogant, and drunk. It's both conducive and detrimental to your relationships. You might get along with your boozy fans after the gig a bit easier, but you risk messing up on stage and having alcohol become part of how you're known to your audience. And the sound guy and bar staff you're rude to when you're drunk will not want to work with you again. It's a totally messed up double standard. Here's some drinks. Go out there and entertain. Wait, now you're drunk. That was terrible. I'm never booking you again. What the fuck? And so you wake up tired again, so tired that your performances are starting to suffer. Your relationships are starting to suffer, and the only constant is there's booze available wherever you go. But it doesn't end there. When you're not getting alcohol for free, when your rider has run dry because you've handed it out to all your new mates, you're stuck buying booze every night, and booze is expensive. suddenly the money you made from door sales and merch from the gig is going towards petrol, food, accommodation, and alcohol. Goodbye profits, goodbye savings. And all this, everything I've talked about, is leading to the end of the road. Alcoholism and death. I don't want to linger here too much because I think it might be slightly towards the extreme end of this admittedly one-sided conversation. But how many times have you heard famous musicians talking about getting clean? Almost every famous musician you can name has at some point struggled with drugs and or alcohol, and they've either gotten help, gone to rehab and gotten sober, and sometimes succumbed to temptation again, or they've died. This is an industry so sick with ingrained indoctrination, distribution, promotion, and glorification of alcohol, it's willing to let its own figureheads die to maintain its dangerous, carefree image. Amy Winehouse died of alcohol poisoning. Billie Holiday died as a result of liver damage through sustained alcohol abuse. Bon Scott died from acute alcohol poisoning. Brian Jones drowned while heavily intoxicated from alcohol and drugs. Janis Joplin died of a heroin overdose compounded by alcohol. Jeff Hanneman died from liver failure as a result of sustained alcohol abuse. Jim Morrison believed to have died of a heroin overdose compounded by alcohol. John Bonham died from alcohol consumption. Keith Moon died from an overdose of a drug used to treat alcohol withdrawal. Steve Clark died from drug and alcohol overdose. Do I need to continue? Because I definitely could. And it's not only the industry encouraging and reinforcing this twisted alcohol culture. It's our friends and families, our peers, our sports teams, and our media outlets. Here's Irma Skutter, a clinic homeopath, certified health coach, recovered addict, and sober revivalist on the matter.
It's a legal drug, number one. So it's not illegal. Yep. And it's not seen as a drug anymore. It's just seen as something we have. We've desensitized to the lethality, to the addictive nature of alcohol because it's so socially acceptable.
Yeah.
The PR campaign around alcohol in modern day time is probably the most successful PR campaign of any drug on planet Earth. If cocaine or heroin or weed had the same PR campaign that alcohol had,
yeah,
we would probably look at those substances in the same way. Because for as long as we can remember, alcohol has been legal, has been available through most social spaces. Supermarkets now stock alcohol. You can go and buy your bananas and your milk and then grab your drug on the way to the supermarket, you know, checkout counter. We don't see it as a drug. I think that plays a big part. And because we equate alcohol with reward, with pleasure, we've been conditioned to believe that we deserve it and it's something we need to celebrate life's big moments and to get us out of our uncomfortable moments.
Yeah.
If you look at the social connection between all of those factors, when we go into any social connection sober, no matter who you are, you're going to feel anxious. It's just how we're wired. Put anybody in a group of strangers and you're going to feel fucking anxious and tense,
yeah,
and unsure. And all of your self-esteem issues will come up to the surface. And alcohol stops that.
Yeah.
Instantly.
Yeah.
It's a great social lubricant.
Yeah.
So we drink because of that, and we drink because it's available.
Mm.
Yeah. It's legal.
It's right there in front
of you. It's right there in front of you, and everybody's doing it. Mm. Nobody questions that it's a lethal drug. Nobody questions or is even aware that that drug is killing more people on this planet than anything else. Mm. Nobody there looks at this liquid in this bottle and sees the destruction and the devastation that it brings. We're not taught to look at alcohol that way.
No, we're not at all.
We see it as it's on the table as we grow up. It's what dad and mum has after work. And it's what you have when people get married. It's what you have when people get buried. It's what you have when people celebrate a birthday. It's what you have when you're upset. It's what you have when you're happy.
Yeah. It's sunny. Let's drink.
It's sunny.
It's raining.
It's raining. Let's drink
red wine instead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the glue that keeps humanity together, which is insane. Because when you start looking at what it's doing to us, and you're looking at the long-term health implications and the cost that's having on economies, and the violence and the destruction, we don't see that shit on billboards.
Yeah.
We see holidays, naked bodies, tan bodies, islands, happy times.
Yeah.
And it's hard to get off that hamster wheel, and it's really challenging to say no.
So how do you start saying no to your own desires? And how do you start saying no in a situation where everyone else is doing it and you might seem a bit lame?
You've got to start by getting more comfortable in your own skin. You've got to love yourself enough to not want to drink. And that's an inside job. There's no magic bullet or one sentence to answer you on that. And I can just talk out of my own experience. I drank for so many reasons, but mostly because I drank to feel like I belonged and that I was included and that I was okay and that people liked me because I was lacking so much of my own self-worth and self-reliance. I had no idea what that was. I was this empty vessel that just placed all of the power on others' opinion of me. So I would do anything to feel like I had a bit of belonging to the group that I was mixing with.
Mm.
So, of course, I drank. And I'm not unique in this. A lot of people do this.
Yeah, because you have to feel, filling it up and being and knowing yourself and feeling confident enough and feeling good enough to be able to deal with the situation socially where you have to say, no, I'm not drinking.
Yes, and also to deal with your anxieties about that, because there's a lot of anxious predictions when you sober up about what a crowd might think of you. In the beginning, when you let go of alcohol, the idea of doing it sober at a party is really overwhelming.
Yeah.
It's normal.
Yeah.
Because you think everybody's going to be looking at you, and you think everybody's going to be questioning you and judging you for saying no.
Mm.
But it's my experience that once you do it and you go into a space, people aren't really that interested in you. They're so self-focused and self-absorbed. This is human nature.
Yeah.
That they want to be the center point. They want to be the focus. And they're not really that bothered whether you're doing it sober or not that night.
Yeah.
What they're bothered about is whether they're having a good time.
Yeah.
And whether they're going to have a drink again once this drink is finished.
Yeah.
There's a moment of awkwardness only because you, at first, it's a big step and a big change in your life. The idea of going to a party without drinking. How am I going to have fun? Is that even possible? How am I going to talk to people? I get so awkward and anxious and all of those things happen in your mind.
Mm.
And yet you go and then you realize it's insignificant in the greater scheme of things because it's a moment where you feel a little bit overwhelmed and then it's gone.
Mm. And it's not that bad.
And it's not about you. If there is a knob jockey in the crowd that has an opinion about the fact that you're sober, it's often because they are dealing with their own demons around their drinking.
Sure. Do you think it is a result of your progression and your age that you have been able to make this step? And do you think it is easier for someone of your age? We're not that far apart, by the way. my age too. You've probably got a couple of years on me. Than it is to, like, the thought of giving up alcohol or choosing not to drink when I was late teens, early 20s, that seems totally not even a possibility because you almost would be ostracized and ridiculed by your peers. Maybe not by your good friends, but if you went to a party sober, you probably wouldn't have it that great a time.
Really good question.
Is it harder?
I think it is harder, especially because at that age, who we are is still so influenced by our external circumstances. If I see what's happening with young adults and how it's encouraged and the pressure to drink and how it's, again, it's accepted, it just breaks my heart because you're setting yourself up. later on in life for possible long-term issues.
And we're doing it to these people, our culture. I mean, you know, we are encouraging our young people to drink. Have you heard something I haven't even thought about up until right now, of the straight edge movement? In punk and hardcore music, there are a group of people started kind of in the 80s, and that survive until this day, that call themselves straight edge, and they obviously abstain from any kind of drugs or alcohol. And quite often it goes over into violence and dietary choices as well, choosing to not be a part of those things. And they're quite outspoken in those scenes. And it's something that I noticed growing up, because I wasn't straight edge, because I was in the drinking culture. And you kind of do make fun of them a little bit, but you notice that they are very vocal and they band together, and it's almost like a little gang, and they're really serious about it. And it's this almost like ultimate punk thing, isn't it? To like, to reject this culture that we're all just obsessed with and go, nah, fuck that. I'm not going to drink. I'm going to have a clear mind. And then to do it as a teenager as well. Really, really strong.
That's courageous.
Yeah.
I think it is the ultimate fuck you to societal pressure and mainstream thinking when you say, no thanks, I don't drink. It's a very rebellious act to do social situations sober.
Mm. And it shouldn't be. It's crazy, isn't it?
Being that one, you're really raising the bar, and it's really confrontational for a lot of people.
Yeah, you're
really making people look at themselves, and it's people don't like that. Mm. And the best form of defense is rejection, judgment, and ridicule.
Mm.
If you are faced with that as a sober person, behind that judgment is a lot of pain. The person judging you is holding on to a lot of stuff, and your sobriety is making them have to look at their stuff. And it's not easy.
Mm.
It's not about you.
Yeah, it's about them.
It's about them. And you learn how to have a thick skin, and you learn how to not take things personally. If you are committed to wanting to explore life without drinking.
Mm.
And I don't think this is something that's just going to shift overnight.
No.
From a creative perspective as well, I for a long time thought I needed alcohol to connect to my creative potential.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we're taught. Especially as musicians, as artists, you are taught that all of the greats were influenced by drugs or alcohol.
Mm.
The Beatles, from everybody. All of the greats made their best music while they're on drugs, apparently, supposedly, and drinking. And so you think that that's how you're going to get there as well.
Yeah.
And most of the time, it's really, really not.
It's everything but.
Yeah.
And again, it's just my experience that nothing severs me more from my creative potential than alcohol. It's like a wedge that occurs between me and my authentic self when I drink.
I'm interested in something that someone brought to my attention a while ago, was the link between artists and mental health issues. Someone predisposed to creativity and introspection is therefore more predisposed to depression and other mental health issues. Would you say that artists maybe have a higher predisposition to alcoholism? Or is it the same across? I'm only speaking from an artist's point of view, so I don't know. But
I think those of us that are more inclined to use our creative potential as a form of expression, and we're all creative beings, but even more so those that go there all the time, like musicians, like painters, like writers, there seems to be a link between mental health and substance abuse disorders and the creative worlds. It might be because the makeup of that particular mind they give themselves more permission to feel, they give themselves more permission to go to a different space of creation than people who sit in front of a computer or at a desk. The chemistry is different, and the dopamine levels of a creative person is very different to someone who works in accounts.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so, yes, there is a link. And do we become depressed because we drink, or do we become drinkers because we're depressed? I don't know.
Yeah.
And I think some people walk this earth more aware of that part of their beings. And it's sometimes it's harder for some people to be here, and sometimes it's not.
Mm.
Some people can go through life and they cruise through life regardless of what happens. And they seem to just come back to themselves a lot easier. And then for others, it's a struggle. And it would seem that those in the creative worlds are more prone to feeling more and experiencing more. Or maybe other people are just hiding it better. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe as artists, we give ourselves more permission to explore that side of our personalities and dig a bit deeper. And also we're putting ourselves out there to people over and over and over again. You know, we're showing our work and our art and our creativity and feeling vulnerable every time we do it. Yeah, maybe it's linked to that as well.
Yeah, the key word is vulnerability. That stood out for me in what you just said.
Mm.
Artists really put out their truth.
Yeah.
So there's such a risk involved there, a fear of rejection and criticism and being misunderstood for that truth. And that's a scary fucking place, man.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
To fully put yourself out there all the freaking time so that you can produce the art that you produce, you've got to allow yourself to be that vulnerable. That's where the magic happens.
Yeah. And that's where people connect with.
That's what people connect with. But far out, the risk we take, because it's like you're doing downward dog naked in front of the Pope. You're so exposed.
Yeah.
And yet it's where we go for our greatest inspiration.
Yeah.
So perhaps that is the key to answer your question. That level of vulnerability that artists give themselves permission to go to, and then the fear and the anxiety that comes with that and the attachment to the emotions that come with that. Of course, if there's something like alcohol or any other kind of substance that promises instant relief, of course we're going to go there, unless we are taught to be with the discomfort differently.
What about not giving it up 100%. Is there a way to, I suppose there is a way, isn't there, to function happily without it?
My simplest answer to that is to develop ways when you are sober that help you to tap into your natural dopamine reserves. Dopamine is your motivation molecule. It's our feel-good molecule. It's a neurotransmitter that connects the neurons in the brain. If you're a creative, this is the shit that you want to have, because dopamine gives you a sense of achievement. It gives you drive. It gives you the will to get through tasks. If you don't have enough dopamine in your brain, you're going to start something, you're going to run out of steam, you're going to procrastinate, you're going to feel overwhelmed, you're going to lack motivation, you're going to lack drive, you're going to lack creativity, you're not going to have the energy and the will to get shit done. If you're charging on dopamine, life feels good. Alcohol and substances, most of our recreational substances, really affect the dopamine levels. That's why we want them. Because they make us feel so good, and it's because of the dopamine. So if you want to cut down on your drinking and you don't want to go there all the time, you've got to rewire your brain. This is neuroscience 101. You've got to find ways to elevate your dopamine levels so that you don't look for instant relief. Because alcohol promises, substances, drugs promise instant relief, because for a moment you have pleasure. For a moment you feel freaking good, but then you have that crash. And that's awful. And then you've got to recover from that. And then often you get the cravings to want to go back there. So you want to break the cycle of craving and seeking and grasping the substance by changing how you do the small things in your life. The only way you can get your dopamine levels charging naturally, sustainably, is by first accepting that this is where you're at. If you're feeling low, if you're getting up in the morning and you're like, oh, I don't know if I can get through the day. It's often all the signs of depression.
Mm.
Those are usually signs that you're low in dopamine. Look at ways to get your levels up. There's all sorts of ways you can get your dopamine levels up. Meditation helps. Yoga helps. Developing a beginner's mind, starting something new, doing something from scratch, learning a new technique, learning a new hobby. That sense of achievement and the quest of learning something or playing a board game that takes a lot of mental focus, like chess. I'm not talking like Monopoly, but something that really involves strategic focus. All of those things enhance your dopamine levels. The more dopamine, the better you'll feel, the less you're going to crave booze. Bottom line, rewarding yourself for a job well done by doing something nice also boosts your dopamine levels. Foods that are high in good fats, foods that are high in protein restores dopamine. Sex, falling in love, that kind of connection, hanging out with your friends, having that real connection, patting a dog, being present with your kids, all of those things up your natural sense of connection. And what it does in the long run is help you be more content and calm and connected to your present moment. And I think at the end of the day, if there's one thing we can do to help us let go of habits that don't serve us, it's to cultivate that ability to be content within that small moment, within this present moment, without needing to escape it. Does that make any sense?
It does.
Irma works in holistic addiction recovery, mental health, and natural medicine. For more of her approach to sobriety, check out the links in the podcast description. So I think that's all for this week. Maybe I've only worked through my thought process a bit further by doing this podcast. It didn't really come to many conclusions, I guess, and it's something that I would like to revisit. But hopefully it's caused some of you to have a think. Maybe it's going to start some conversations between listeners and between me and some listeners. If there was a moral to this podcast or an overall message to take away from it, I think it would just be to consider your influences, consider your motivation, consider your choices, and just to look after yourself. It's not always cool to drink. Maybe next time you're about to get on stage or go to rehearsal or even out with friends, take a look around and ask yourself, why do I need a drink to do this? I want to say thank you to Tom Anderson and Irma Skutta for sharing their thoughts. Check out the episode notes to find out more about them. The artist of the week is Giraffes Giraffes. Check them out at giraffesgiraffes.com and facebook.com/giraffesgiraffes. Also, while you're on Facebook, go to the Musicians Map page at facebook.com/musiciansmap and hit like. This podcast and the website musiciansmap.org is dedicated to sharing knowledge and advice about music and the music industry. It's all about community, honesty, and positive progress. The experiences, stories, and advice shared on the podcast are given freely with the hope that you can relate to them and benefit from them. If you've found this podcast enjoyable or useful, make sure to check out the Musicians Map ebook and audiobook about building success in music. You'll find it at musiciansmap.org/books, Amazon, and Audible. And buying a copy of the book directly contributes to the continuation of this podcast. There's also a free ebook, How to Get Your Music Heard. Go to musiciansmap.org/free-book to get your copy. If you have a suggestion for the podcast or for the YouTube channel, or you just want to get in touch and say hello, please do so via the Musicians Map Facebook group or by email at kane@musiciansmap.org. Thanks for listening and stay positive.